Good evening, everybody. Mike Malloy here, or there, or somewhere. Welcome to the program. Did you watch any of the hearings today? Oh, my God. We're going to focus a little bit on that today, or tonight. I'm not sure how much, because it was just maddening. Although, we do have for you, was it Representative Ackerman, Gary Ackerman, the Democrat from New York, at the subcommittee hearings on AIG today. He said some things that just were funny. I mean, even in this situation, what Ackerman said, and of course it was funny at the expense of the freaks that were sitting at the witness table in front of him. It was just all around fun day. If you have a very bleak, macabre sense of humor, our friends from Code Pink were there, thrusting their signs in the faces of these rat bastards immediately after the hearing was adjourned this morning. That was interesting to see. Bless their hearts. I swear to God. You listen to the Code Pink people and you think, you know, why aren't the members of the committee asking these kinds of questions? But Gary Ackerman damn near did. So we're going to get to that. Also, next hour, I'm going to share something with you that is lengthy, but it's probably the second most important thing that I've ever read on this program, the first being when we revisited 1984. This is a piece written by Robert Friedman, Robert Freeman, just a couple of days ago. And it is, to me, powerfully important, and it's lengthy. It will take us over and through a couple of station breaks, but we're just going to do it because I think it's important that what Freeman wrote be heard. And when we're finished, I'll tell you where you can get your own copy. All right. Now, let's go back to St. Patrick's Day. Yesterday, because we had that was yesterday, right? Time is just warped out for us here at the Malloy program. I guess it has for you too, right? Too many things happening too quickly. Nah, I'm not going to talk about Hannity and the rest of these devils over at Fox News. Screw those people. They have absolutely no reason to be alive except to raise hell and cause trouble for decent human beings. So no, I'm not even going to get into that and the Chris Dodd thing. Maybe tomorrow. But St. Patrick's Day. You know my position on religion. I kind of set it aside for these religious festivals, especially the Christian ones, because those are the ones, and I realize they were all stolen from old religions. From pagan religions, but the Christian ones, because of what I was brought up, you know, Easter, which is the spring equinox, Christmas, which is the winter equinox, what else? Halloween, all those holidays that were co-opted by the early Christians when they spread their message across Europe, I still find the celebrations, as long as the religious nuttery stays out of it, to be great fun. So I got this today from a listener in Prague in the, is that the Czech Republic now? Yeah, I think it is. Mike, I listened to your show religiously, laughing out loud, and I loved your Irish music at the beginning of your program yesterday. I'm listening to the podcast now. I happen to be both of Irish descent and a practicing Wiccan, and so I wanted to share my own thoughts about St. Patrick's Day. Did you know that Patrick was not Irish? He was a Christian missionary from Wales who went to Ireland on a religious mission and waged a murderous campaign against pagans in Ireland, mainly Druids, who already practiced their own forms of native Celtic religion, from which we still have many of our traditions. I used to celebrate St. Patrick's Day until I learned more about it, but as a Wiccan, I cannot celebrate a holiday intended to honor a Christian missionary who the Catholic Church made a saint to reward him for killing pagans and destroying their worship sites. I feel that my religion, Wicca, is very disrespected, And I have failed to find forthcoming religious tolerance among many, especially Christian Republicans in my family. Moreover, this may shock you, but St. Patrick's Day even insults me as an Irish American for the same reason it insults me as a Wiccan. When children in the U.S. learn about, quote, chasing out the snakes from Ireland, end quote, in school, no one ever explains to them that it was ethnic cleansing. Someone should. I respect you if you don't agree with me and don't want to ruin your shamrock celebration, if they would just rename it Guinness Day and remove the reference to the evil St. Patrick, perhaps my past enthusiasm would return. Thanks for your show, and thanks again for the music. Jesse in Prague. I think I'd heard that once before. Driving the snakes out of Ireland had to do with ruining people who didn't accept the superstitions of the Christian church. Oh, well. Just thought I would toss that in. Isn't that always the case, though? I mean, really, the Christians stole all these holidays, all these pagan holidays, turned them into something they were never intended to be, and then kicked the asses of the people who set the holidays up to begin with. Ah, terrible. What do you got here? Let's get Prairie 2's missive into the mix right away, our economics correspondent. Prairie 2 writes tonight, Thomas Friedman and other flat earth proponents have been pushing the notion that Americans have been consuming too much. This is an idea that appeals to many on the left from a green standpoint, and on the right, and the right thinks this means everybody but them. What Thomas Friedman is really getting everybody ready for is that China isn't going to send us care packages anymore. China has already cut shipments to the U.S. dramatically, and inventories are falling. This has been masked by store closings and the reluctance of consumers to spend money. When consumers do return to spending, if they ever do, we could start to see empty store shelves. With corporations accelerating the outsourcing of jobs and consumer credit becoming a thing of the past, we could be looking at an entirely new definition of the term middle class. It could mean somebody whose extended family can save enough yuans to buy a washing machine. Oh, God. The good news is this. Small business lobby groups are very pleased with a host of new tax breaks and loan programs that Obama presented to them in a meeting on Monday. These weren't really innovations on the part of the Obama administration, but rather things they had lobbied for, but had been ignored by the Republicans. There's a billboard that I pass on the way to town that says, "We support small business. Vote Republican." When I get to town, I have to cross a mainline railroad. I used to see a trainload of Chinese shipping containers every 20 minutes. They're much more infrequent now, but I'm not sure I feel good about that. Not yet. Prairie 2. Yeah, remember back during the this crazy campaign that was waged by John McCain and the other one? And they insisted, oh, and Joe the plumber, remember that half-ass whose name was not Joe and who was not a plumber? But it was put out there over and over again and repeated in the Fox echo chamber, of course, repeatedly that Obama was going to raise taxes on small businesses and kill them all. And now small business lobby groups are saying they're very pleased with the new tax breaks and loan programs that they're going to get from the Obama administration. Where is Sarah Palin and John McCain about this? Where is, oh, never mind. Just kidding. But it only bolsters and underscores what I've been saying for a long time on this program. The Republicans lie about everything. They never, under any circumstances, tell the truth. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Molloy.
Bye. Hey, Truth Seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
Well, I am humble. 21 past the hour. Kay in San Francisco writes, regarding the corporate hypocrites that she saw today, Mike, I had to laugh out loud in order to keep from screaming when I heard the right-wing blowhards talking about AIG's so-called responsibility to, you know, honor its contracts with the recipients of those obscene bonuses. These are the same characterization deleted. These are the same who had no problem breaking a contract with people like my friend who spent nearly 30 years working for United Airlines. United workers in his generation all had contracts that specified retirement pensions and benefits. And you know what? The corporate bastards reneged. Funny, I don't remember hearing any talk about contract law back then. The hypocrisy and the chutzpah of these greedy, characterization deleted, is unbelievable. And yes, I am even more angry than I normally am today, and it's showing in my language. Pitchforks and torches. Kay in San Francisco. I hear you, Kay. All right. Here's Representative Gary Ackerman, Democrat in New York. The subcommittee hearing today, he finally laid into AIG executive Edward Liddy for the $165 million in bonuses on taxpayers' backs and for selling insurance without having any revenue to actually pay any claims.
You're selling something with absolutely nothing to back you up. You have no money, possibly in your pocket or your wallet. And if everything goes right, you're collecting a premium. And if everything goes wrong, so what? Makes no sense. It's like snake oil salesmen selling you jars of snake oil, and they don't even have the oil in the jars. I mean, there's a great company called, I can't believe it's not butter. You know, at least they have the decency to tell you it's not butter. I mean, this is insurance without being insurance, because if they called it insurance, they'd have to have money to pay you off. But they don't have the money to pay you off, and they're calling it credit default swaps, because if they called it, I can't believe it's not insurance, maybe nobody would buy it. This is exactly, I mean, it's a funny joke I made up, but this is exactly what's happening. And it's not funny because all of us who are laughing are crying and getting angry and getting enraged. This old school teacher is going to give you a little bit of advice. Pay the $165 million back. That bonus money that has been given out, circumstances understood very clearly. You have a legal question here. But you have received or have access to $197.3 billion of U.S. taxpayer money. $165 million adds up to this old math teacher is less than one-tenth of 1%. That's not worth the aggravation, the angst that you have suffered and that this country is going through. Give that back. Cut your losses in financial terms. It just ain't worth it.
You know, there was something else that he said that was funny. I'm going to misquote it, but maybe it wasn't Ackerman. It was somebody. Oh, and also, did you hear the guy on the committee say goddamn on national television today? Yeah. Some of these guys were really, really irritated. But Ackerman, I'll probably screw this up, but he said these credit default swaps. Let me give you a very quick explanation or definition of what they are. You got two guys in a life raft. They're in the middle of the ocean with huge 10-foot waves. They're adrift. The one turns to the other and says, oh, my God, I'm scared. What are you scared of? I'm scared I'm going to die. Here, I'll sell you an insurance policy. That's what the credit default swaps are. Nothing. Words. Garbage. It's astonishing what has happened. I said the other night that the AIG thing is just a sideshow, and in a very real sense it is. But it is indicative of the disrespect that the corporate elites, the right-wingers, the Limbaughs, you know, here's Limbaugh telling people, Limbaugh makes what, $30, $40, $50 million a year, telling people how they're supposed to think about these bonuses. Well, they got a lynch mob out there now trying to take away people's money. Because Limbaugh knows that if the pitchforks and the tar and the feathers ever comes out, his ass, all of it, will be one of the first to get tarred and feathered and sent back to the Dominican Republic so he can, I don't know, get some young people to pick all the tar and feathers off of his bloated, ugly body. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Standing up to the flying monkey right, it's Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. Matt in Ohio writes, Mike was listening last night and someone mentioned that Manchester United soccer team being sponsored by AIG. Well, it's true, to the tune of like $56 million or so. So I wrote to Manchester United and asked when I get my full hospitality VIP tickets. As part owner of AIG and as U.S. taxpayer, but native Manchester person, I think I should be high up in the queue. Incidentally, Manchester United lost 4-1 to arch rival Liverpool last weekend. Seems like AIG is dragging everyone down. Matt in Ohio. What about John McCain? Have you been following the situation? We're going to get to the heavy-duty stuff here, but there's some little items. If you're a regular listener to this program, you know we like to get some of these little items out. Otherwise, they get lost in the stack and they never go anywhere. If you've been following what's been happening to Meghan McCain, the wife of daughter of Senator John McCain, she has been attacked by right-wing kook fringe asses like Ann Coulter and Laura Ingraham. And the most recent was she was attacked not over her ideas, but her body composition. Because what Meghan McCain said was she didn't understand Ann Coulter, didn't like her, didn't like her books, couldn't understand what the hell she was talking about. She doesn't agree with this right-wing nutball conservatism that is eating the country alive. She says, yeah, I'm a Republican, but, you know, this stuff is nonsense. Again, I'm paraphrasing. But she failed to see any humor or any reason for Ann Coulter to be breathing. I mean, what's the point? Well, Laura Ingraham and Limbaugh and Ann Coulter, I guess Ann Coulter hasn't said anything publicly, but her supporters are. And today, according to Digby, today in this Twitter view with ABC's George Stephanopoulos, McCain shied away from condemning Laura Ingraham's gratuitous attack on his daughter. Stephanopoulos asked McCain, what do you think of Meghan's feud with Ann Coulter and Laura Ingraham? McCain first said, I'm proud of my daughter and she has a right to her opinions. And then Judas Stephanopoulos asked if he agrees with his daughter. McCain didn't say. He simply said, like any family, we agree on some things and disagree on others. So, as John Amato at Crooks and Liars writes, what kind of man is this that he can't even defend his daughter against personal insults from the likes of Laura Ingraham? He doesn't even have a political motivation, as low and cynical as that might be. He won't be running for president again. He's never been a favorite of the right wing, and he has no reason to curry favor with them now. Everything we know about him would suggest that he thinks right-wingers like Coulter are political poison. I think he believes that Meghan deserves to be spoken to like that because he probably speaks to her that way himself. Although she's quite lovely, she's not physically a Barbie doll like her mother or Sarah Palin or Ann Coulter or Laura Ingraham, which is what he thinks is important in a woman. So he can't bring himself to defend her. She asked for it. Whenever I find myself getting down about something the Obama administration is doing, all I have to do is picture that man occupying the White House, John McCain, and I immediately bring myself back from the brink. Imagine. I know families can be complicated. I have to deal with my 82-year-old father who just pulled a not-so-smart move that I'm not happy about, but who doesn't have a family issue. I wouldn't stand for a character attack on him, though. So I'm kind of shocked that John McCain used Twitter to comment about his daughter and kind of disturbed that he hung her out to dry. John Amato writing at Crooks and Liars. But that's what Republicans will do, and I don't know why that is difficult for anyone to understand. I agree with Amato. McCain no longer has any political reason for doing this. He's not going to run for any. Oh, he might run for Senate again, I guess. I don't know when his term is up. But he claims to not like right wingers, the religious right nutballs. Limbaugh tried to ream him a new body orifice back during the primary season. Remember that when Limbaugh wanted the religious nutball Huckabee to run to be the nominee. Oh yeah, that would be good. That would be good. Rush Limbaugh supporting Reverend Huckabee. But McCain, you know this as well as I do. There are huge pieces missing from the puzzle that is John McCain, and those pieces are loyalty, respect, unity, character, strength. He likes to tout his strength. Well, I survived 5 years as a POW. Yeah. Okay. All right. Good for you. But all those other things that you knew and I knew and most thinking people could knew and could see in his body language, he's a scumbum. That's all McCain is. He's a broken down scumbum. And now he won't even, or he didn't even, defend his own daughter. You know, don't you think that McCain should have got up on his hind legs, maybe in the well of the Senate, where I believe he's protected from any kinds of lawsuits, and said, if I ever see one of these bitches, I will just beat them into the dirt for going after my daughter and making snotty remarks like that. Wouldn't that have been more appropriate to someone named John McCain, you know, fighter and yada, yada, yada. Oh, well. Rick in Mesa, who is involved at Arizona State University, writes, Mike, I've taken calculus, differential equations, and linear algebra, but I can't seem to grasp all these business concepts, the derivatives. Oh, I know the calculus applied to science is no different from calculus applied to economics, but economics has this extra variable, greedy bastards mucking at the system with illogical systems on systems. In science, it would be like devising a mathematically sound experiment, setting it up and spitting on the lens or a detector. Well, I guess if you could scam some money out of such nonsense, it could be done, or it would be done. Perhaps that explains the handful of scientists who get paid by the oil companies to go around arguing that climate change is nonsense. Anyway, why are all these markets upon markets upon markets, each more obscure than the previous? When you think about it, the stock market itself is an abstract notion in which few people make more money on the work of others than the workers themselves. On top of that, We have these hedge funds and derivatives. We need a new superhero, Integral Man, Rick and Mesa.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Rick. Oh my God! You want to comment on the stuff from the hearings today, the AIG hearings? So let's do some calls. The phone number here is 877-99 Malloy. If you do it the other way, it's 877-996-2559. 877-996-2559 is the number here. Or 877-99 Malloy. 877-996-2559. Or is it 2556? I don't know. Go back to the letter way. I have no idea what our new phone number is. 877-99 Malloy seemed to work last night. God damn it, let's try it again tonight, huh? This is interesting. Chase Manhattan Bank, huh? J.P. Morgan Chase, I guess I should say, Chase Manhattan ceased to exist a long time ago. J.P. Morgan Chase, experts are saying that the bailout of our banking system, which is not going to happen, it really isn't, could eventually cost American taxpayers as much as $4 trillion, including the $25 billion already handed over to J.P. Morgan Chase alone. So how is J.P. Morgan Chase rewarding the American taxpayers who went further into debt to save Chase and 118 other financial institutions? Well, here's how. Beginning April 1st, what is that, 2 weeks? Chase will arbitrarily raise the interest rate on over 400,000 of their small business and individual credit card customers to prime rate plus 11.99% and even higher for cash advances, which would put current credit card interest rates at about 15.25%, almost doubling many so-called fixed rates of their best customers. It's astonishing. It's astonishing what is being done, isn't it? Don't you agree? Now, because they're raising the interest, and a lot of businesses, I know in setting this one up, we had to use some Visa credit that was available to us in order to get things cracking here. But it happens to be a no-interest credit card. And when I think about all the small businesses that do use, now that banks have pinched their asses so tight together, nothing's going to come out, they have to use credit cards. And some of them have been paying 8, 9, 10%. Now all of a sudden it's going to be 15, almost 16%. And you know what will happen when the businesses can't finance themselves? Then everybody will start screaming, well, it's Barack Obama's policies, right?
They sentenced me to 20 years of boredom for trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now, I'm coming to reward them.
Truth seekers, gather round the campfire. It's more Mike Malloy.
It's 10 before the hour. Coming up next hour, I'm going to share with you this piece by Robert Freeman, which to me is the second most important thing I have ever or will have ever read on this program. The first being way back in the day when we read 1984. Let's go to your calls. Who we got here? Britt is calling from Columbus, Ohio, listening online. Hey, Britt.
Good evening.
Hi.
Good evening, fine sir. I find it an honor to talk to you.
My pleasure.
One thing I have to say, I did not watch the hearing. I don't think I have enough kale pectate to deal with this crud.
I hear you.
But I do have to say this. ever since I've, you know, thank God for the internet, you know, because I've been listening to one show at a time.
Uh-huh.
Through all the archives, you know.
Right.
Whoever kept your archives did a masterful job.
That would be Ben Birch.
I want to thank him for doing that because that kept my sanity.
Uh-huh.
Because there is so much, I am a runaway from the corporatism.
I hear you.
Okay? And you helped illuminate that, okay?
All right.
And what I think is, my voice is needed, okay? Not just my voice, but whoever is listening to your show.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think you tried to wake us up. Like you say, get the crud out of your eye. You know, wipe the dust out of your ears.
Right,
and all that.
Right.
I just think that we're just like in oblivion. This is like financial shock and awe here because all this stuff is happening around us, but none of us are moved to action unless we do something.
Well, I'll tell you what, Britt, thanks. I appreciate what you had to say. As a matter of fact, the piece that Robert Freeman wrote that I'm going to share with everybody next hour kind of ties directly in with what you're saying, so stick around for that. Otto is calling from Los Angeles, listening on KTLK. Hey, Otto.
Hey, Mike, how are you? I'm a fan.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I think you're terrific. I listened with interest at your kind of indignation that McCain didn't defend
his daughter, right, right.
In 2000, he didn't defend his other daughter against Carver's push poll in South Carolina, and didn't defend his wife's honor when the whisperings about Cindy's drug uses came out. I mean, he's got a history of doing what's politically expedient and not really caring about his.
Well, that's what made this incident unusual. Granted, McCain doesn't defend his own family members. It's an outrage, but. That's because he was running for president, you see, and he wanted those knuckle drag mouth breather votes from South Carolina, but he's not running for anything, and he probably never will again, unless maybe it's try to get reelected to the Senate. So that's why his refusal to defend his daughter against these harpies is I can't understand that.
Well, I think it's a knee jerk reaction that, you know, when I shouldn't say anything because, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's so ingrained in him by now. I mean, I used to, you know, this is back before I read a lot, I guess, and I kind of admired McCain.
At one point, so did I.
But I think the last straw for me though was when he didn't have the stones to kind of take the gloves off and say, you know what, attack me all you want,
right,
really.
Right.
To say whatever you want about me.
Yeah.
But you don't talk about my kids, you don't talk about my wife.
Yeah.
My family out of it.
Yeah, I hear you. Otto, I got to leave it there. And when I say so did I at one time, find him kind of interesting, I don't mean I supported him. I just found him to be what he claimed during this last campaign, and that was a maverick. Now, the period of time I'm talking about, of course, was back in the 90s when McCain, at least in attitude, I don't know what his voting record was back then. It was probably just as scurrilous as any other Republican in the Senate. But McCain had this mouth on him that and again, this is before I knew anything about him, you know, about his refusal to defend his family, whether it's his adopted daughter or non-adopted daughter or his wife or himself. Against these filthy pigs who claim to be Christians and are not. They are swine who hide behind the cross and use the Bible to beat the hell out of people. But I know what you're saying, Otto. He was kind of interesting back then, right? Who we got here? Bobby calling from Petersburg, Virginia, listening on the internet. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
I'm all right.
Man, listen to your show every week.
Thank you, thank you.
And love your show, man. Love your show.
Thank you.
I called last night. I was on hold. I was one of those callers that couldn't get through.
Okay, I got a minute here.
Yeah. anyway, I know there are several states that have Bush up for war crimes. Washington State is one of them. How many states are there, actually?
That in the Union?
Yeah, in the union.
50?
Yeah, I mean, I know it's 50 in the union. No, I'm talking about how many of the states actually have him up for war crimes. But
you mean the past resolutions?
Correct.
I don't know. I think two or three, but there've been a lot of township, or not townships, but small towns and county commissions have passed these resolutions saying he should be tried for war crimes, but nothing that's enforceable.
Right. And I have one more thing I have to say. I would like to see a debate between you, Randy Rose, Tom Hartman as the Three Musketeers against Bush, Condi, and Dick Cheney, the Three Stooges. What do you think?
Oh, we'd beat them to death. It'd be no contest. Bobby, I got to go. Thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in. It'd be no contest. That's why, politicians tend to stay away from this program particularly. Excuse me. I guess it goes back to, was it Air America? No, it was IE America days when I used to hang up on the Speaker of the House and... remember that, Gabby? Because he used to piss me off, you know.
Well, one time that wasn't intentional.
Well,
you hung up on Dick Gephardt and it was an accident.
Right. Well, that one was an accident, yeah. All right, stick around. We have a break here. When we come back, I'm going to share with you what I think is the second most important thing I've ever read on this program. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. It is 6:30 past the hour. A couple of years ago, on a whim, when I was working at Air America, Kathy and I decided to read the entire book, 1984, on the air. And we used to do a slight segment every night. As a matter of fact, Air America was supposed to try to get us a sponsor for it. Of course, they never did. But... we always felt that was a pretty important reading. What I'm about to share with you now, I think, is equally important. In early 1919, Germany put in place a new government to begin rebuilding the country after its crushing defeat in World War I. But the right-wing forces that had led the country into the war and lost the war conspired even before it was over to destroy the new government, the Weimar Republic. They succeeded. The U.S. faces a similar Weimar moment. The devastating collapse of the economy after 8 years of Republican rule has left the leadership, policies, and ideology of the right utterly discredited. But as was the case in Germany in 1919, Republicans do not intend to allow the new government to succeed. They do everything they can to undermine it. If they are successful, the U.S. may yet go the way of Weimar Germany. World War I left Germany utterly devastated. The landed aristocrats, industrial magnates, wealthy financiers, weapons makers, and the officer corps of the military that formed the locus of right-wing power were completely discredited. Their failure in provoking and prosecuting the war was catastrophic, undeniable, and complete. The economy was destroyed. Prices were at 800% of pre-war levels and rising quickly. Agriculture, pillaged for the war, lay in ruins. Social insurance payments for the war's injured, to widows and orphans, and newly unemployed soldiers were astronomical. And all this was before the cost of rebuilding was even begun. At the same time, Germany faced massive reparation payments to the Allied victors, France and England. But Germany's foreign properties had been confiscated and its colonies turned over to the victors. The combination of these conditions, both domestic and international, made it extraordinarily difficult for the German economy to recover. As a result of the failure of the right, the German people elected a moderately leftist government to lead the nation's rebuilding. It was named the Weimar Republic for the city in which the new post-imperial constitution was written. The new government was led by Friedrich Ebert, head of the German Socialist Party. But the country's new parliamentary system had allowed dozens of parties to run, making it impossible for any one party to win an outright majority. Ebert's party had achieved the highest portion of votes, 38%, in the first post-war elections held in January 1919. Ebert would have to govern by coalition. It was at this time that the right wing made its crucial decision. Despite its shocking, naked failure over the prior decade, despite the horrific devastation it had wrought on the German people, despite the discrediting of everything it had purported to stand for, they would fight Ebert, his new government, and his plans for recovery. They would do everything they could to make sure that the new government failed. Their strategy was twofold. First, stoke the resentment of the population about the calamitous state of its living conditions, no matter that those conditions had been created by the very right-wing oligarchs who now pretended to befriend the little guy. Rage is rage. It is glandular and unseeing. Once catalyzed, it is easy to turn on any subject. And stoking resentment was easy to do. Just before the war ended, the military concocted its most sensational lie. The German army hadn't actually been defeated. It had been stabbed in the back by communists, traitors, and Jews. It was an easy lie to sell. It entwined an attack on an alien political ideology, liberalism, with the latent, pervasive myth of German racial superiority. The second strategy of the right was to prevent the new government from succeeding. To begin with, success of the left would conspicuously advertise the failure of the right. Moreover, success by the left would legitimize Republican government, so hated by the oligarchs of the right. Much better for the people to be ruled by the self-aggrandizing right-wing autocracy that had governed Germany for centuries. So the rightists set out to do everything they could to make it impossible for the leftists to govern. They would use parliamentary maneuver, shifting coalitions, domination of the new mass media, legislative obstruction, staged public relations spectacles, relentless pressure by narrow but powerful interests, judicial intimidation, and eventually outright murder of their political opponents. Contrition for their abject failure, humility for their destructive hubris, compassion for their crippled country, those had nothing to do with it. All the right possessed was a blinding, visceral hatred of the left and a masturbatory lust for the return to power. Eventually, they succeeded. Every setback in recovery, and there would inevitably be many, was met with hysterical demonizing of the left-wing government. The lie was repeated relentlessly that the government was run by communists and traitors and Jews, the same furtive cabal that had purportedly stabbed the country in the back at the end of the war. They steadily chipped away at the efficacy and thereby the legitimacy of successive Republican governments. By the time of the Great Depression, Adolf Hitler's ironically named National Socialist Party had become the biggest vote-getter in the nation. The Nazis had once been derided as the lunatic fringe of the far right. But the so-called respectable right-wing power brokers, who had started and lost the Great War, anointed Hitler Chancellor in January 1933. He immediately suspended the Constitution, abolished most civil liberties, he outlawed opposition parties, began a massive military buildup and a relentless propaganda campaign, and set Germany and the world onto the path of the greatest destruction it would ever know. America now faces its own Weimar moment. The failure of right-wing policy here and leadership over the past 8 years, especially in matters economic, is comparable to Germany's right-wing failure in World War I. It is catastrophic, undeniable, and complete. Consider, according to the World Economic Forum, 40% of the entire world's wealth has been destroyed in the recent financial collapse. In the U.S. alone, between housing and the stock market, more than $18 trillion in wealth already has been destroyed. The private megabanks that anchor the financial systems of the Western world are bankrupt. This makes it all but impossible to jumpstart the Western world's economies, which are heavily dependent on bank system credit to operate. More than 10,000 homes go into foreclosure every day. More than 20,000 people lose their jobs every day. And the collapse is accelerating developing its own self-reinforcing dynamic. Job losses breed foreclosures, reducing demand, leading to more job losses and further degradation of the financial system. None of the stopgaps designed to staunch the bleeding have yet worked. There is no bottom in sight. Meanwhile, debt has risen to astronomical levels. Reagan and Bush 1 quadrupled the national debt in only 12 years. Bush 2 doubled it again in only 8. It is now 10 times higher than it was in 1980 when Reagan was elected. Total public and private debt exceeds 300% of gross domestic product, half again higher than it was in 1929. The government's unfunded liabilities, promises it has made to the American people, but for which no payment source can be identified, now exceed $60 trillion, a literally inconceivable sum that can never, will never be paid. Federal Reserve economist Lawrence Kotlikoff has suggested that the U.S. government is actuarially bankrupt. The full measure of the nation's plight is revealed in Hillary Clinton's first trip as Secretary of State. It was to China to beg them to fund Obama's new fiscal deficits. Without loans from China, the U.S. economy cannot be revived. The significance of this cannot be overstated. The U.S. no longer exercises sovereignty over its own economic affairs. That sovereignty now resides in the hands of China, the United States' greatest long-term rival. All right, that's part one. Part two when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
I've seen the nations rise and fall. I've heard their stories, heard them all. But love's the only engine of survival. Your servant here, he has been told to say it clear, to say it cool. It's over. Get ready for the future. It is murder. Bang the ball and slide. In all direction. Won't be nothing. Won't be nothing you can measure anymore.
Arm yourself with the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
It is 21 past the hour. All right, back to this piece written by Robert Freeman. The U.S. is facing a Weimar moment. And he's referring to what happened in Germany after World War I. And now he brings us up to what is happening here. Thanks to Republican policies of massive debt and shipping jobs abroad, the U.S. has technically become a colony of China. It exports raw materials and imports finished goods, together with the capital to make up the difference. Should the Chinese decide not to lend the trillions of dollars the U.S. is begging for, the U.S. economy will implode, plummeting onto itself in a World Trade Center-like collapse that will leave dust clouds circling the planet for decades. Notwithstanding the destruction inflicted on the economy by Republican policies, the most devastating breakdown is in the intellectual foundation on which right-wing economic ideology itself is premised. Free market doctrine, the secular religion of right-wing America, is in utter, irretrievable shambles. One of the most lofty tenets on which free markets are premised is their claim for themselves that they are efficient. That is, that market prices always reflect so-called fundamental values of the assets. But if that's true, how could the world's largest insurance company, AIG, have lost 99.5% of its market value in only 18 months? How could the world's largest bank, Citibank, have lost 98% of its value over the same period? How could the world's largest brokerage company, Merrill Lynch, have gone bankrupt and need to be bought by Bank of America? How could the world's largest car company, General Motors, have lost 95% of its value and stand on the threshold of extinction? How could the world's largest industrial conglomerate, General Electric, have lost 85% of its value in only 18 months? If the largest companies in the world, those at the very heart of the capitalist system itself, can lose virtually all of their value in only 18 months, what is the possible meaning of the phrases efficient markets and fundamental value? The other core tenets of free market ideology are equally compromised. Major actors are clearly not rational, a breakdown of theological proportions admitted by no less an avatar of the cult than its Pope himself, Alan Greenspan. Free markets clearly cannot, will not, regulate themselves. It is precisely their innate, irrepressible propensity for sociopathic greed and predatory fraud that has brought the whole of the world's economy to the precipice of collapse. Free markets clearly do not align risk and reward, allocating capital to its most productive uses, as its promoters advertise. They clearly do not automatically return to equilibrium, but must be bailed out with trillions of dollars of injections from the shrinking coffers of the public to the ever-bulging coffers of a private priesthood of pillage and plunder. And in perhaps the greatest indictment of all, one going back to its primeval roots in Adam Smith's 18th century opus, The Wealth of Nations, the unrestrained behavior of self-interested individuals clearly, manifestly, does not coalesce as if by an invisible hand to the greatest good for the greatest number. It does not. These are not peripheral premises that have failed. They are not tangential tenets. Efficient markets, rational actors, market equilibrium, risk and reward, self-interest, these are the essential sacraments on which the entire free market system is founded. They are in tatters. And it isn't that any one of them has been discredited by the glaring, merciless force of events. All of them have been. All of them together. And all of them at the same time. Free markets have long been the basis for a legitimate, though rightly debated, economic policy framework. But they have become little more than a robotically recited cultural catechism, a mindless mantra mumbled to mask the looting of the nation's resources that is the true purpose of Republican economic policy, as demonstrated by the staggering upward transfers of wealth that inevitably occur under Republican regimes. A more complete, conspicuous, catastrophic, and irrefutable repudiation of right-wing leaders, right-wing policies, and right-wing ideology could not possibly be contrived. So what is the right-wing response? They have adopted the strategy and tactics of the failed right-wing plotters in Weimar Germany. First, stoke the resentment of the population about the increasingly dire state of its living conditions, no matter that those conditions were created by the very right-wing oligarchs who now pretend to befriend the little guy. Rage is rage. It is glandular and unseeing. Once catalyzed, it is easy to turn on any subject. That's part two. Part two when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy.
Thank you.
Get your news unfiltered, only with Mike Malloy.
It's about 26 before the hour. We are reading a piece by Robert Friedman, The U.S. is Facing a Weimar Moment, his reference being what happened to Germany after World War I, when it found itself in financial condition that brought about the rise of the right-wing Nazis, even though it had been the right wing that had destroyed the country. And the comparison he's making here is between the situation in Weimar Germany and in 1919 and the situation in the United States in 2009. 90-year separation, and the comparison is not exact and in a perfect equilibrium, but his points are certainly well thought out and well stated here. What he's saying is, let me back up just a sentence or two. So what is the right-wing response to everything that has collapsed under Republican stewardship? They have adopted the strategy and tactics of the failed right-wing plotters of Weimar Germany. First, stoke the resentment of the population about the increasingly dire state of its living conditions, no matter that those conditions were created by the very right-wing oligarchs who now pretended to befriend the little guy. Rage is rage. Once catalyzed, it is easy to turn on any subject. Second, prevent the new government from succeeding in any meaningful endeavor. The Republicans have set all their efforts to doing everything they can to make sure the Obama administration fails. Rush Limbaugh's infamous, "I hope he fails," pronouncement is only the beginning of the fomenting of hatred from the right. As Limbaugh said, quote, "Let's be honest, every Republican in America is hoping for Obama's failure," end quote. The same malignant hope oozes unadulterated from all the other dogpatch demagogues that rent themselves out to the Republican Party to foment resentment against anything liberal. Joe the Plumber, Rick Santelli, Glenn Beck, Michael Savage, Ann Coulter, and virtually every other right-wing nut operative whose intellectual stock and trade has been vaporized by the collision of right-wing policies with objective reality. Equally so for the so-called respectable members of the party. The all but three Republican members of Congress who refused to sign on to Obama's first stimulus package and continued to grandstand against every effort toward any form of progress. Contrition for their own abject failure, humility for their destructive hubris, compassion for their crippled country, those have nothing to do with it. All they possess is a blinding, visceral hatred of the left and a masturbatory lust for the return to power. But what else can they do? Bereft of ideas, bankrupt in ideology, architects of collapse, destruction is all that, obstruction is all they have. If Obama is successful, it will not only advertise the full extent of their failure, it will provide a model of liberal governance that would render Republicans irrelevant for decades, much as FDR's success left them out in the political cold for an entire generation. Liberal failure is a matter of life and death for Republicans. And it's not all that clear that the liberals won't fail. No one should underestimate the task at hand. Never before, not even during the Great Depression, has the country inherited such a daunting and tractable set of economic problems. A debt burden so crushing, inequality so vast, a loss of financial sovereignty so constricting, an intellectual edifice so bankrupt, a private economy so uncompetitive, or an opposition so callously self-interested in its own recovery and so cavalierly disinterested in the nation's. The economy has been so damaged. Successful rescue requires threading a series of policy needles, each of them so complex in their own right that none could be solved by any administration of the past 50 years. This includes rehabilitating and re-regulating the nation's banking system, restructuring health care, reducing national dependence on oil, reviving manufacturing so as to reduce the trade deficit, rebuilding the nation's crumbling infrastructure, dealing with a soaring national debt, trying to resuscitate a collapsing housing market, and all the while maintaining the safety net under 77 million baby boomers entering retirement with a net worth 60% what it was only 18 months ago. Success will require much more than luck, hard work, brilliant policy, or soaring rhetoric. It will require cooperation and contribution from every American. It is those two offerings, cooperation and contribution, that Republicans are intent on withholding, the better to ensure Obama's failure. Simply put, the Republicans hate Democrats more than they love America. and if they succeed in derailing Obama's efforts, the cost will be incalculable. After World War I, one of the consequences of the liberal government's failure was Adolf Hitler. Hitler had a genius for exploiting the resentment of the German people for their condition. More than 80% of the Nazi Party's members were unemployed. It was these legions of idle thugs who made up the ranks of Hitler's brown shirt militia, the SA. The right-wing oligarchy that had set out from the beginning to destroy the Weimar Republic recognized the potency of resentment and Hitler's genius at exploiting it. It was they who sponsored Hitler's ascension to chancellor in 1933. Resentment and obstruction are all the right-wing in America have to peddle. Their policies are utterly discredited. Their ideology, even by its own standards, is a sham. They are so bereft of leaders, their de facto leader is a former drug-addicted, thrice-divorced radio talk show host. That is literally the best they can muster. But they have built a national franchise inciting the downwardly mobile to blame the government, not the right, for their problems, exactly as Hitler did in the 1920s. The Republican propensity for fascism must not be underestimated. Witness their phony justifications for the war in Iraq, fanning the flames of nationalistic aggression, just as Hitler did with Austria, the Sudetenland, Czechoslovakia, and Poland in the 1930s. Consider their symbiotic embrace of corporate interests in the oil, weapons, telecommunications, pharmaceutical finance, and other industries, the same type of corporate interests that sponsored Hitler's ascent to power. Look at their efforts to dismantle civil liberties with the Patriot Act and the Military Commissions Act, or the relentless, pervasive propaganda laundered through their corporate-owned right-wing media machine. These are the classic hallmarks of fascism. The strategy is to obstruct recovery, facilitate collapse, and then incite the faux populism of public resentment to reinstall a corporatist oligarchy which has failed, but which will not abide a reduction of its privileges or a diminution of its control. It is a fetid, seditious agenda, awaiting only its own latter-day mustachioed messiah for its final fulfillment. World War I was a once-in-a-millennium upset in the architecture of global power. In 4 years, it shifted the center of that power from Europe to the United States. But failure now by the United States will shift that center once again from the United States to China, out of the Western world where it has resided for the past 500 years. The psychic shock to the billion-odd people living in Western civilization with its liberal democracies, capitalist economies, and enlightenment ideas will be incalculable, irretrievable. The shift may be inevitable, and only a matter of time. It is quite possible that the damage inflicted on the Western world's economy by rapacious Republicans is already beyond repair, but it will be tragedy beyond measure if such a shift is consummated by the very wrecking crew that took us down the road to ruin, all the while so unctuously proclaiming patriotism as its crowning ideal. They are not patriots, and their goal is not the revival of American power. It is the revival of their own power, even at the expense of America's. They represent a very dangerous threat to the nation's future. Robert Freeman writes on history, economics, and education. If you want to contact him, he can be reached at Robert Freeman 10 at yahoo.com. Robert Freeman 10 at yahoo.com. And if you want a copy of this essay, go to commondreams.org and find Robert Freeman, and it's there. This is one of the more well-written and scariest essays that I think I've read in a long time, in a very long time. You know, a lot of people are saying right now, Jesus Christ, if you people in media don't stop with the negativity, nothing's ever going to repair itself. And I try to find little little glimmers of hope, but I'm having a hard time, and it's because of exactly what Freeman has laid out in this critical essay that I think should be required reading for everybody in this country now that can read or gives a damn. Because like Freeman and his references to Weimar Germany in 1919, I am fearful of the rise of these neo-Nazis. I watch it every day. I watch people like Mitch McConnell, like John Boehner, people like Rush Limbaugh, this whole cadre of right-wingers who are so intent. You know, I've been saying this for 5 years. This is not a revelation. You know it too. They want to destroy America if they can't have it their way. And their way is a updated model of slavery with a ruling elite and the rest of us down here in the slime. Well, it is, it takes some resistance. It takes some courage to resist this, if that's not redundant. And I realize you've got it. I goddamn sure have it. So think about what our response is supposed to be.
Cleaning up America one flying monkey at a time. It's More Mike Malloy.
It is 10 before the hour. Regarding Freeman's essay here, is there any more proof of the accuracy of what he's writing than what occurred immediately after Barack Obama was sworn in as president? And do you remember he invited these filthy pigs, these Republicans, to come into the White House, to come have dinner and drinks, to get together and chew the fat? He went up to Capitol Hill to visit with them, trying his goddamnedest to get some cooperation as the country is facing what we're facing. And what did he get? They spit on him. They spit on him. You can only imagine what the Republican right-wing pigs said behind his back. But to his face, they didn't have the courage to stand there and say, listen, President Obama, we don't agree with anything you're about, and we're going to try to stop you every chance we... No, they didn't say that. These slimy bastards drank his booze, probably smoked his cigars, went into the house where his wife and children now live, muddied up the furniture with their stink, and then walked out laughing. The comparison between the yet-to-be-born Nazi Party in Germany in 1919 and these thugs that now comprise the Republican Party is very striking to me. When you hear the term obstructionist, that does not have a nice connotation or meaning to it. Obstructionists in this regard are people. What are they obstructing? Think about it for a minute. They have so many of these poor, miserable sons of bitches around the country with their tea parties believing that what they are obstructing is government spending. God damn! I mean, this is just beyond belief. The two Bush crime families have, and the Reagan crime family have sunk the country into trillions of dollars of debt. The biggest spender where it concerns the public money after Lyndon Johnson was George W. Bush, the rat bastard who just left office. But Americans don't pay any attention to fact, for the most part. They don't. They'd rather listen to some piece of human waste like Glenn Beck, or some drug-addled freak like Rush Limbaugh, or some parrot like Sean Hannity, or some evil woman like Laura Ingraham or the rest of this crew of harpies. Tell them what the truth is. Without checking anything, without believing. It's astonishing. It's astonishing. Well, when I say I'm concerned or frightened by or afraid of the right wingers, and not from a personal safety, I really am not. Not for the past 20 years. They had me on the run a long time ago, until I got armed. You know, until I finally realized these sons of bitches are just sick enough, and they hate America enough, and I'm in a part of the country that is absolutely seditious, doesn't give a goddamn about the Constitution. It is a white Christian supremacist part of the world. Okay, so I'll arm myself. I'm not afraid of them personally. I'm afraid of what will happen to the experiment that the framers gave us 232 years ago and said, here, keep it if you can. Keep it if you can. And to think that the energy that has brought this country to this level and may take it out completely if we don't somehow figure out a way to resist, that energy came from within. It's not the Soviet Union that killed us. It's not the Chai Coms that killed us. It's not the Muslim Islamists that killed us. It wasn't Hugo Chavez in Venezuela that killed us. It goddamn sure wasn't the Sandinistas, right? You know, we're sitting here, and I'm not saying we're dead. I'm just saying we're mortally wounded. Severely wounded, let me put it that way. And if at this point in our history we allow ourselves to even listen to this right-wing garbage, I mean, it's astonishing. Unemployed, working-class Americans who are listening to anything that Rush Limbaugh has to say? What in the hell is wrong with that picture? Here is a pig, a filthy, degenerate, drug-addicted, just the worst kind of human being. If you had to devise somebody who is antithetical to everything this country stands for, it would be Limbaugh. With his hundreds of millions of dollars in income, setting himself up as a populist leader? Jesus God, where does that come from? It comes from the drones, the sheep, the people who are so willing to give it up to Hitler. Limbaugh. Father Coughlin. Joe McCarthy. You know, we've had them in this country, and they have shown up around the globe repeatedly. They're demons, if you believe in that kind of nonsense. To me, a demon is not some supernatural being. It is someone who, for whatever reason, maybe he was molested by a parent, maybe, you know, whatever the case is, they wind up being self-loathing individuals who project it out on all the rest of us. And given power, like Limbaugh, that projection can have fatal consequences. So, I don't know, man. You decide. You decide, folks. You decide what you're going to do about this. You know? I mean, I have to make that decision every morning when I get up. Every morning when I get up, I make a decision. Do I do something that might be considered illegal, or do I take my kid to preschool? So far, it's take a kid to preschool. Welcome back. 6 and a half past the hour. This is the Malloy Program. Email here from Claudia in Kentucky regarding Freeman's fees. She writes, Mike, the only saving grace I can come up with in response to the chilling Freeman article is that Obama won by such a majority of the vote that we have his back, so to speak. He didn't take office with consent from 38% of us, but a healthy majority. Republicans, it is true, are trying to undermine him at every turn, but I believe we will not allow them to con us into submission. Am I too optimistic? Claudia in Kentucky. I don't think anyone can ever be too optimistic. You know what I'm saying? I have to be optimistic. And the main reason I have to be optimistic is, you know, I have a 4.5-year-old daughter and grandchildren and, you know, and grown children that I would like to see have some sort of a life, you know, other than, you know, picking seeds out of a devastated field someplace. Or learning how to trap and cook squirrels, you know? Not that that's anything wrong with that, but you know what I'm saying. I'm optimistic. But like I've been saying, the Republican Party has to be murdered. That's certainly a metaphor, but I don't know that I meant it metaphorically. I guess I did. You can't murder a political party, can you? You can suffocate it by withholding funds from it, which is going to be impossible in this society because of the horrendous link between failed Republican policy and corporate America. I've said this for 4 years, if anyone, and I always wait for these right-wing pissants who try to get, you know, their degenerate little emails in here to me, but they're blocked. And they get an automated response instead. We just look for keywords, you dumbasses. But I've been waiting for any right winger in 4 years to give to the audience of this program one example of anything that the Republican Party has not completely destroyed in America. I've tossed out everything economically. The practice of religion, if you have to go there, the military, the environment, retirement, medical care, education, anything that the Republicans haven't destroyed. And the destruction is evident not in what the plan was, no child left behind. No. In the outcome of these stupid, ridiculous, nonsense, corporatist policies. And you know what? In 4 years, not one of these cowardly little sniveling right-wingers has ever been able to call this program and usually not even get past the first two or three sentences with their nonsensical remarks, well, did you ever serve in the military? You know, that kind of crap. They can't do it. It is a failed ideology, utterly failed. And I guess that's why they have become such sheep, such followers. They're willing to follow right-wingers, Republicans, conservatives, as they exist today, conservatives. They're willing to follow anybody. Whoever farts the loudest for these people will be the one that gets their attention. If it's farts coming from Limbaugh, they all head that way. If it's farts coming from the governor of Alaska, they all head that way. If it's farts coming from Sean Hannity, then they moo and go that way. They're leaderless, rudderless bunch of idiots that still support policies that are destroying their lives, destroying their families, destroying their health, their children, the planet. This is a part that has intrigued me now and fascinated me and disturbed me for a decade. Why do Republicans, the voters, keep doing this? And I've come to the conclusion it has to be genetic. They must be genetically programmed to self-destruct. And I have no problem with that. Kill yourselves. God damn it. Do what Charles Grassley suggested for these corporate people. Go ahead. Off yourselves. Get off the planet. If that's what you want to do. But there are a lot of people on this earth who would like to have a chance. And they don't think a goddamn tax cut constitutes their chance, especially when it's a tax cut for the upper one half of 1%. You silly people, you really are, you right wingers. I I spent a lot of time trying to understand what your ideology was. And then I came to the conclusion that it was irrelevant. And then I came to the conclusion that it's relevant only in the sense that it is so massively destructive that it can bring down the entire planet. Hello? You people are should be ashamed. Anyone who votes Republican should be ashamed. Let's open up the phone lines here. The number is 877-99-MALLOY, or if you do it the other way, 877-996-2556. 877-996-2556. And I want to hear what you have to say about what we've been talking about this evening, okay? Let's not talk about 9/11 or the Kennedy assassination or Gaza. Let's focus on what we've been talking about tonight, okay? Kathy is going to screen the calls to that effect on what we've been talking about tonight, all right? 877-996-2556 is the number. I'd like to hear from you, so bring it on, as they say. Now, I get emails after the show that, you know, from people who like the program, but they say, Malloy, are you ever, ever, ever going to stop being so negative? And, you know, I'd like to answer all the emails I get. Now, obviously, I can't. They're just too many. But when I do try to answer, it's like, look, you know, being negative about what's swirling around you. I mean, if you're drowning, you can't be positive about the water that is taking your life. I mean, of course you're going to be negative. Jesus Christ, I'm drowning. Yeah. But that doesn't mean I'm not optimistic. Well, surely a piece of driftwood will come by and I can grab hold. You know, that kind of thing. So am I negative? I'm just beyond negative. There is not a word. I am breathtakingly negative about what I see has happened in my own country. In fact, on my own planet, but especially here in my country, because I know where the responsibility and the blame and the fault lies. And it lies in a failed ideology. This is the genesis of it. This republicanism, this republican ideology that has failed in every single thing it has ever attempted. It has never succeeded. If by success, we mean, does it advance the well-being of people in this society? Does it contribute to the well-being of people around the earth? I mean, do you have a better measure of success than that? Oy. April is calling from Royal Oak, Michigan, listening on the internet. Hey, April.
Oh, hi. Hi. It was my first time I called.
Well, hi.
Hi. I noticed just about a, must have been a month ago, you started really focusing in on capitalism.
Yeah.
And I've been really focusing in on it too, right along with you every day. And also, you know, and I realized the trueness of it, that capitalism is responsible for all the things that are going wrong. You know, even the ozone hole getting bigger,
right.
The wars. I mean, literally, I really believe you're right that it's threatening the world's existence. I mean, it's really serious.
Yeah,
all this stuff that
yeah.
You've been ranting about how bad this administration and corporations are, it's like really hitting me really big now.
All right, what now that you've been hit by it, and I've been there. I know what you're talking about, April. You know, I was brought up probably the same way you were. You live in Royal Oak. I was brought up in Toledo. You and I probably had basically, although I think Royal Oak was a little bit higher per capita income than where I lived in Toledo, but it hit me in the head, too, with the full force of, I'm guessing by your voice that you're fairly young. It didn't hit me with its full force until I was in maybe my 30s. And you sound a lot younger than 30, am I right?
No, I'm 55.
You're 55?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. All right, let me put you on hold because I want to come back and talk to you a little bit more. 55? Kathy, she sounds like a teenager. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. Stay with us.
conservatives. Don't be afraid. Be very afraid. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. All right, let's go right back to it. We were talking with April, who called in from Royal Oak, Michigan. You fooled a lot of my listeners, too, April. I got just a rush of emails here saying, we thought she was a teenager, too.
Oh, you know, I'm a member of the Raging Grannies.
Well, you have a very deceptive phone voice, but that's cool. All right, so before I digressed you, you were talking about your own concerns about this stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. It's just really coming together for me in the last month. I've been listening to you, you know, every day for a long time, but just the last month or so, it's really coming together. I just thought we had a real big pain in the ASS. Government and that, but I didn't realize so much that the corporations and everything,
right,
and how serious it is. It's really hitting me now.
Well, I think it's hitting a lot of people, April, and it is scary, right?
It is.
And I don't, you know, I've said before, if you're a regular listener, you know, I've said many times, I don't have any answers. I can identify problems like most of us can, but some of this stuff is so big. The corporate model is so entrenched in all of our lives that I don't know. It'd be like having a wisdom teeth extracted with no anesthesia to get these bastards out of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
I still think that it can be done. It depends on Barack Obama's courage. Because he is, for better or for worse, given the times he's got to deal with, he is the leader. I don't know if he's going to be able, I don't see how any one person could withstand the onslaught from the right wingers, although he seems to have a fairly good formula for dealing with them. He makes nice, and then he ignores them if they won't even open, you know, like he said in his inaugural address that was addressed to Islamists, if you unclench your fist, we'll shake your hand. Republicans cannot unclench their fists. They're cowards, they're sneaks, they're liars, but they're terrified of somebody like Barack Obama. And you don't want to know the truth. They'd be terrified of someone like you because you have not taken the, which pill was it? The blue pill was the one that kept you in the Matrix. I can never keep that straight. So,
the Matrix?
Yeah, you're familiar.
Yeah, I just got done watching the Matrix.
Was it the blue pill or the red pill that kept
it
you?
Was, the red pill was the right one to take.
Yeah, so the ones who swallowed the blue pill were the ones who were willing to just go ahead and let the system destroy them. You obviously are not one of those people. Neither am I. And I think there are millions of us out here. So keep the faith and stay in touch. All right, April?
Yeah, I wanted to say after you said that, yesterday or the day before you said that about the Matrix, and I went and rented it.
Oh.
Because okay. I wanted to hear what you were talking about.
Well, it was a difficult movie for me to understand the first time. I think I got it the second or third time.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, April. Take care. And do call in again, all right? Rhea is calling from Rochester, New York, listening on XM Sirius. Hey, Rhea.
Hi, Mike.
How are you?
I'm great, thank you. And it's a real pleasure to listen to your show. I enjoy your show every night.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
I wanted to make a comment about what we're going to do with these Republicans.
Okay.
And I think that the president, when he talks about, I'm losing my thought.
Well,
I'm nervous.
Well, that's
he
right.
He talks about, I was going to say, if you can't beat them, expose them.
Yeah, that's
transparency.
Yeah.
And it's playing out before everybody's eyes. All we have to do is just pay attention and just let things play out.
Hey, let me ask you, Rhea, are you talking to me on a cell phone?
No.
Oh, okay. I'm just checking because I'm getting a weird sound, but it's probably here, so don't worry about it. If you can't beat them, expose them.
Yes.
Yeah. The only thing that or the major thing I should say that worries me about Barack Obama is that. Either because of his youth or because of his life experience, he seems to be the type of people or type of person who believes that you can trust people and that if you demonstrate that you trust them, not to operate against their their own interests, but trust them to do the right thing. He believes, I think, that if you show people, look, 2 + 2 really does equal 4, that they will say, oh, that's right, it does equal 4. Man, all this time I thought it was 2 + 2 = 5. He trusts people to be able to see the truth. He trusts people that if you reach out to them, they'll respond by reaching back. And I think that while that's his strength, it's also his weakness.
You know, I agree with that. And I think that it's going to take, like, you know, if you keep banging your head up against the wall, sooner or later you're going to figure out, hey, that hurts.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. Rhea, thanks. I got to leave it there. Thanks a lot for checking in. I appreciate the call. I hope it's not our phone system. This echoey, nasty sound we have. Oh, well. And we can't just call Ian out in Phoenix and say, fix the phones! Everything's right here. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Take what's there.
Renegade Talk Radio done right, from the left. It's Mike Malloy.
It is 26 before the hour. Someone just sent this to me. Is this from Think Progress, I think? A few weeks after Obama was inaugurated, Dick Cheney gave an interview to Politico going after Obama's detainee policies. And Cheney, of all people, was warning that Obama was making America less safe. Now, he repeated those charges again last Sunday on, what was it, Press the Meat or whatever program? No, it was on CNN with this miserable son of a bitch, Sean King. Oh, my God. What an enabler King is. But anyway, do you remember Lawrence Wilkerson? He was Colin Powell's former chief of staff who left the Bush administration in protest. He wrote an essay on the Washington Note, I think it was last night, slamming Cheney's fear-mongering. Wilkerson, former chief of staff to Colin Powell, calls Cheney evil. Doesn't say he's negative, doesn't say he's got wrong ideas. He calls him evil. And he goes on to say that Cheney's policies assisted, his word, terrorists. I think this is a quote from what Lawrence Wilkerson said. The McLean being a Canadian newspaper, I believe. Cheney went on to say in his McLean interview that, quote, protecting the country's security is a tough, mean, dirty, nasty business. These are evil people, and we are not going to win this fight by turning the other cheek, end quote. I have to agree, but the other way around. Cheney and his like are the evil people, and we certainly are not going to prevail in the struggle with radical religion if we listen to people as he, Cheney. And then later on in the piece, Wilkerson goes on to say, but Al-Qaeda will be back. Iraq, Gitmo, Abu Ghraib, heavily biased U.S. support for Israel, and a host of other strategic errors have ensured Al-Qaeda's resilience, staying power, and motivation. How we deal with the future attacks of this organization and its cohorts could well seal our fate, for good or bad. Osama bin Laden and his brain trust, Ayman al-Zawahiri, are counting on us to produce the bad. With people such as Cheney assisting them, they are far more likely, to succeed. Well, it's about time. I mean, you know, I don't understand why the real adults in this country are not stating the obvious. Cheney, Bush, every one of these sons of bitches were evil. And to a degree, so was Wilkerson's boss. Colin Powell, who sat there in front of the United Nations and said the things that he said. And if he didn't know they were lies, by God, he should have known. He was the Secretary of State at the time. Back to your calls here. Claudia is calling from Bowling Green, Kentucky. I think I just read your email, didn't I?
Yeah.
Well, hey, Claudia.
Yeah, well, that's what I called about, but I've been listening, and I just love, tell Kathy her music is awesome.
Yeah, she's...
That's my favorite CD from last year.
Oh, really? Yeah, it's she plays some good music.
John Mayer.
Yeah, Mayer is great.
Well, I tell you what I called about is that you got caught up in my kind of rhetorical question at the end and kind of missed my point, which I wanted you to talk about. And that is the idea, the fact that Obama won with much greater than 38%, which I felt like that was a big factor in the German situation, that they were so fractured.
Right.
They didn't have anybody who could really strongly lead. I think in our case, in this case, we do have someone who can strongly lead. And, I just thought that might be how our situation can be different. I don't think the majority of the voting public is going to allow the Republicans to undermine him. I hope I'm right.
Well, no,
there are times when it doesn't look that way, but
yeah, I got what you were saying, Claudia. I did. If it didn't come through in what I was saying, yeah, I got that part. I'm just not sure. Short of turning them as many as we can out of office. There is not a whole lot we can do about the propaganda that floods this country 24/7 by right-wing talk radio
and more and more
right-wing talk television. It's just a monstrous effort to destabilize the country, and it's being run by the corporatists, the very people, the same class of people that the American public now has to bail out are the ones continuing the destruction. It's mind-boggling. But the only thing we might still be able to do, even though the elections are pretty much decided by the corporate structure in so many instances, that's not true necessarily when you get down to the state and the district level, congressional district. When you vote for senators and members of Congress, one still has more control, let me put it that way, more power than in a presidential election. So the only thing I can think to do, short of armed insurrection, frankly, is to continue to have faith in our system and to work for candidates who will not only resist what's going on, but turn it on its butt by reinstituting regulation, by clamping down on these right-wingers, in other words, by just reaffirming what we were supposed to be all about from the beginning.
And expose them.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
I think that the conversations that are cropping up now in the media about the unfairness of right-wing radio being in very liberal major cities like Chicago and
New York,
and that is finally, I believe, becoming an issue that is being discussed and being questioned in the maybe even in Congress now.
Well,
let's just hope.
Well, I hope that there is a redistribution of radio bands so that liberals, every one of us who works in liberal talk, it's been a constant struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Unless we are fake progressives or fake liberals that are absorbed into the system and still pretend like we're progressives. And there's a number of people out there like that who profess to be liberals or progressives and they're not. But those of us on the left, and I'm not talking about the radical left. It's impossible to be in the radical left these days. You would get no exposure at all. But just the left as it represents something that is better than this right wing garbage that we have now. We have always been marginalized. I don't care. You know, even after we tried to form our own network, Air America. It was taken over almost immediately by right-wing types who cared not a damn what the message was, but just decided to figure out some way to use it as a vehicle for their political ideas or to make money. And as a result of that, of course, it went right down the toilet. Hey, listen, I got to go. Claudia, thanks.
Thanks for talking.
All right. I appreciate you checking in. Take care, dear heart. Appreciate it. Tom is calling from, he's driving in Portland, listening on XM Sirius. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right.
Hey, listen, I want to make a point about the Republican Party.
Okay.
I feel that they are pretty much white Christian-dominated leadership. They're struggling for survival. And they've hijacked religion much the way that the Taliban have, you know, where they were able to be, have a male-dominated society. And if you look at who they call their base, it's the right-wing Christian.
And mostly white, if not all white, and mostly male, if not all male.
Right, but also they've hijacked the social issues to bring along the so-called social conservatives.
Right.
And they've confused a lot of the main issues to confuse the rest of them, you know.
Yeah.
You know, for example, I'll give you an example of this Bill O'Reilly guy here. He wrote a book. My wife read it. She said she really liked it. And I said, you know, tell me about it. And she said that, you know, it's culture warrior, you know, and he talks about a secular state and this kind of thing. And he wants religion back in, you know, in God we trust and all that back into politics or back into government, excuse me. And I said, well, wait a minute. I think the guy wants Christianity back in government, but I don't think he wants Judaism or Muslim or whatever.
Right.
So, see, that's the points that are lost on a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah, it is a point that's lost. And these are just pure theocratic monsters, Tom. Their brand of Christianity is the Mel Gibson kind, the bloody, battering, dripping, filthy kind. It's not the kind of Christianity that would offer a hand of compassion to fellow human beings. That kind of Christianity is pretty much dead. If it ever really lived at all, Tom, I got to leave you there. Thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in. I was going to say something regarding Tom's call, but it's completely gotten away. We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Before the hour, Kathy Bay engineered the program and produced it tonight. Our economic correspondent is Bruce Enberg. Our ethical advisors, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf. Sharon Gordy is our military affairs correspondent. Ben Birch, technical advisor, and we'll be handling the podcast for this program in a new kind of way. A note on the Malloy program. I think by the 1st of April, is that about right, Kathy? Within 2 weeks, we will have the new Malloy website up, which will be highly interactive, unbelievably interactive, unlike anything. For those of you who have been following this program all these years, what we have in mind working with two very good people, John Sinton and Ron Hartenbaum, is going to be a mind blower. it really is. So now I don't know if we'll be, you know, if we'll be able to afford to stay in business. But I'll tell you what, when it first starts out, it's going to be impressive to say the least. So watch for it. MikeMalloy.com. This new site is coming soon. Okay, back to your calls here. Alicia is calling from Sherman Oaks, California, listening on the internet. Hey, Alicia.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, is this the author, the writer, Alicia?
It is.
The book, The Price of Right. I'll tell you what. When I know you're going to ask me if I've read it yet, and the answer is
okay.
The answer is going to be no. But I'll tell you what. When we do get our website up for people like you who listen to this program and write a book, we will do our damnedest on the website to make sure that people are aware of it and go to wherever it is that the link will take them to buy it. Okay.
Thanks so much.
So hang in there.
Okay.
And the name of the book, by the way, that Alicia wrote is The Price of Right. Right being right wing. So check around if you want to. The Price of Right. Now, what you really called about?
Well, pretty much what the book is about is that, you know, I've been wondering about why it is that people support these policies that are so, you know, so destructive to themselves.
Right.
And after, you know, this is the conclusion I've come to is that, you know, there's several groups. You know, you have your big business conservatives,
mm-hmm.
and you have your religious conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that binds them together is the metaphor that money equals morality. So
right.
This is the same reason that they can have, you can have these mega churches with the guys with the big Learjet,
mm-hmm.
and they have absolutely no problem in respecting those people because they think that if you have money, if you have money and power, then you have acted morally, and the result of your moral action is that you've been rewarded by money and power. Therefore, you deserve to be in charge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'd like to know where that religion comes from.
Well, it's not even thought of. It's more, you know, it's from this unconscious level that, you know, it just seems right to them. It seems right. And so even really poor conservatives will support the people that, you know, have, you know, that think that money and power is, you know, the most important thing to have.
You know, and that's the part that all my conscious life, when which should probably be about half of my life, when I began to consider these, the very thing you're describing, and I've never been able to place it in the context of reality, what these right-wingers do. Because here's the thing, you know, when we're born into the world as a result of just some kind of sperm and egg fluke, we come in naked and squalling. When we die because of the breakdown, usually the breakdown of our organs, our internal systems, we go out the same way we came in, with absolutely nothing. And if we're lucky, we go out consciously, and as little pain as possible. But when the end comes, it comes. So the thing that's always fascinated me, don't these people understand the ephemeral or almost non-existent quality of possessions or power or money or I've got six Rolls Royces in the garage? What the hell is wrong with these people?
Well, you know, you mentioned it earlier, and if you get a chance to look at the book, you'll see that I talk a lot about this. I believe there is a genetic component to this. I don't think it's all genetic, but I think it has to do with, you know, when we were hunter-gatherers and then when we became a agricultural society.
Right.
You know, we did not become acquisitive until, you know, until we were agricultural.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And you know, the necessity to, you know, to hoard and to have more than somebody else and to have to protect what you have from other people. You know, I think that there is a genetic component that has come down to us through history and the people that, you know, that label themselves conservative are the people who believe that they, you know, that money and power and stuff, you know, is the reason, you know, is what we have to have.
Well, what a damn shame, because they are so wrong.
And, absolutely.
And what a way to live your life, you know?
It just doesn't work is the thing. Like, you're right. This is a completely failed ideology. Every man for himself, and if everybody maximizes their self-interest, we'll all do better. Well, we've just seen, you know. I mean, I wrote this 2 years ago, and I feel like a Cassandra, as you do, I'm sure.
Sure.
You know, that it's all come home to roost. It's all, you know, just played out like we said that it would.
It's all right there. Alicia, we're out of time. I got to go. All right.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you, Alicia. Stay in touch.
Okay.
And when we do get the website up, yours will be one of the books that we'll feature, I promise you. For the folks that are on hold that we didn't get to, I apologize. We'll do it tomorrow night for sure. Thanks for hanging out tonight. All right? Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.